Log Talk Radio.
My life.
It's Monday night, and that means it's time for the Constitution Hour. Of course, the Constitution Hour is brought to you by Patriot Families. That's Patriot Families with a YS.com. And I want to welcome our guest in the chat room, Miss Linda Sills, and of course, Mr. Robert Luke. And on the call-in line, we've got Mr. Robert. And Robert, I'll get to you in just a few, but I've got some things that I want to get started first, and then we'll bring Robert into the discussion. And picking up a page from Mikey B in the hot seat, I want to read to you a little bit that's been on my mind lately, and I know you've heard me talk about rebuilding Babylon. And I truly believe that or not any of the folks involved understand that that is the game they've been roped into, it is nonetheless the reality. So I want to read to you from Isaiah 14:12. How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning. How you are cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations. For you have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I will also sit on the mount of the congregation, on the farthest sides of the north. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Yet you shall be brought down to Sheol, to the lowest depths of the pit. Those who see you will gaze at you and consider you, saying, is this the man who made the earth tremble, who shook kingdoms, who made the world as a wilderness and destroyed its cities, who did not open the house of his prisoners? All the kings of the nations, all of them sleep in glory, everyone in his own house, but you are cast out of your grave like an abominable branch, like the garment of those who are slain, thrust through with a sword, who go down to the stone of the pit, like a corpse trodden underfoot. You will not be joined with them in burial, because you have destroyed your land and slain your people. The brood of evildoers shall never be named. Prepare slaughter for his children because of the iniquity of their fathers, lest they rise up and possess the land and fill the face of the world with cities. So, over the weekend, I did something that I don't often do. I spent a little time watching television, and they're truly, usual, was not a lot on. And I happened across a panel discussion, a panel discussion that tried to posit itself as some sort of debate on the role of the black church in modern society. And I ran across this program, and I found myself inexplicably drawn back to it, and listening to some of the things that these people were saying, and it's quite radical. So the first clip that I'm going to play you is a young lady named Anthea Butler, and she is the head of religious studies at Penn State University, or maybe not, but she's a tenured professor. This is what she had to say in one clip, about 3 minutes long.
But we ain't in the New Jerusalem. We are fighting for Jerusalem right now. I laughed at the title of this panel because I was like, this New Jerusalem, this is like the Crusades right now. We are fighting for our very democratic rights right now. And part of that has to do with the church. And if you don't believe that, all I have to say is Trayvon Martin, and you will understand, and we'll talk about that. But one of the things that people in the black church need to understand is that the religious right took your playbook. They took your playbook from the civil rights movement. This is why they have so much power right now. At least they think they have power. Let me put it like that, because temporal power and spiritual power are not the same thing. They are not the same thing. We do not wrestle with flesh and blood, but against principalities and powers. And I've been wrestling with principalities and powers this week from the right wing, and I just want to look at this mic and tell you right now that I serve the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And that's the God we serve as black people. But we can critique this American God that's got us in the thrall of capitalism and craziness, that has us not looking at our communities because we're looking to give the pastor a whole bunch of money for pastor's anniversary. Okay? Let me go ahead and call this out. See, we haven't talked about, there's a bunch of women sitting in church right now that are giving all their money to pastors that are messing them over. We have to talk about the bad things that are happening, but we also can talk about the good things that are happening in the black church. Souls to the polls, people getting people out to vote in the 2012 election, things that are happening in our inner city communities where churches are working to stop nonviolence. And so this can't be an abstract discussion today. It has to be a serious discussion about where we are going, because people are walking away from these institutions. They don't care about institutions. Every institution in this nation is failing right now. It's not just the church. The government is failing. People don't work. We elect leaders and they ain't working. And if you went to your job and did what the Congress did and the Senate did, they don't work. So churches are doing the same thing. Churches are having issues right now. And how do we build up the black church to be that institution that it needs to be within our communities and to make those bridges across religious lines, because it's not just about Christianity. It's about all the rest of these religious traditions we have in the African American tradition. And it is a moment where we have to come together or we will fail. This democratic process is trying to crush us right now, or at least what is passing for democracy. It's really a right-wing theocracy. And you need to begin to think about how the message of the gospel, the pure, unadulterated message of Jesus Christ, was a radical message that said, you know, we for the poor, we are for the brokenhearted, we for the folks that don't have no money to go to the hospital. It's not this other God. So we need to really be the people who are out there saying, look at who God's supposed to be in our communities, and stop making it about something else.
So it's...
Wow. Look at who God's supposed to be. Really? So now we have a black community shaping God into what they believe God is supposed to be? And where did she find this doctrine in the scripture about helping the poor people that don't have enough money to go to the hospital? I must have missed that chapter. I must have missed that entire ideology in the Holy Bible. And a right-wing theocracy? Really? You truly believe that? These people are insane. And Rod Luke, you are absolutely correct. It is all about a progressive agenda and nothing to do with God other than using God as a sounding board, using the religious underpinnings of a large sector of the black community and manipulating and twisting the gospel of Christ into something they can use for their own progressive agenda. That is exactly what these people are talking about, and it's disgusting. Now, here is the second clip I wanted to play for you that just kind of exemplifies what's already been said and try to follow along, because they seem to talk incessantly using or trying to use big words to exemplify or exonerate their intelligence, which is the sign of most atheists, the self-proclaimed intellectuals.
Blessed are you poor people. We're talking about the parable of the Good Samaritan. We have responsibility, not just freedom. We have responsibility. That's the basis of the biblical witness. Now I'm going to leave it there. So I'm getting ready to get carried away here.
I think it's important for us to understand, though, Overy, that there's an argument to be made.
Right.
That is to say, you could posit the view that the gospel is this. So we can do the textual analysis and show that Jesus spoke about the poor X number of times, and that this particular interpretation from the right is a distortion of the gospel. And that's the beginning of an argument. But when we look at the odd coalition around Prop 8 in California, right, Mormons and black folks, as a kind of real kind of baseline mobilization of interest. But when I'm in New Jersey, you know, Wyclef Jean called New Jersey the New Jerusalem, so I was kind of confused when I first saw the title. So we were talking about New Jersey or something. Right, but the idea that joke fell flat.
The Fuji song. I'm with you, Eddie.
But the idea of all of these black preachers standing behind Chris Christie, who's decimating the education system, who's demonizing public teachers, who's killing black folks, day in and out. So, but they have an argument. They're making claims on the basis of their Christian witness. And what what I'm saying is that over the last few decades, what has stood in for Christianity as such has been a particular conservative interpretation of what it means to be Christian. And in its wake, progressive Christians have acted like they can't stand on their interpretation of what it means to be a Christian and be committed to same-sex love, of what it means to be Christian and to be dedicated to the poor. So in some ways, the public voice of Christianity has been this conservative voice that you want to say is wrong. And then we've witnessed the demobilization of more progressive voices within the Christian community. And so what it seems to me what is needed is not to say that's just wrong, this is the interpretation. It seems to me that we need more progressive Christians to come out and make intense arguments.
Intense arguments.
Extraordinary uses of social media with the same kind of savvy that these folks who are coming out of the Mormon church and begin to make the argument
that
on Christian grounds that we can in fact support
intensive
this and
bullshit.
That and this and that. So you know, you see what I'm trying to argue.
Because that's why I wrote the Politics of Jesus. And you talk about we're going on. We have a new generation of folk. But what we have to do is we're not saying it's wrong that these people's political stance is wrong. What we do have to point out though, in context. The constellation of biblical ethics says this. The main thing in the Hebrew Bible, the main concept is mishpat, justice. Justice. We don't even talk about justice anymore.
Oh, my God. Where to start? You notice in the very beginning of the clip, the guy comes out and he talks about freedom. But then he says also with that is responsibility. I could not agree with this guy more. He's absolutely correct. You have freedom and a corresponding responsibility. And then, of course, the other guy, man, is chawing at the bit to cut him off and correct him, okay, and try to reel him back in because, brother, you're getting too close to really saying what's in the scripture here. And that's a message we're trying to fight against. We're trying to create a new message in our image and a new God in our image. The black God, right? Where there is a redistribution of wealth. Absolutely, Linda. Oh, my God. It's disgusting to hear this, I mean, what passes for intellect? Are you kidding me? This is supposedly a group of intellectually astute individuals, and they are arguing in circles. They can't even get their own mishmash straight. And yes, the scripture is very much about justice, but what they're missing, I believe, in their reading is the fact that justice cannot come from the hand of man, which is why man could not keep the law. The law was not what provided justice. My God, go read your Bible. Go read your scripture. These people should be ashamed. Two of them self-proclaimed pastors. One of them, Protestant minister, even though he's certain what he's protesting, but I'm not sure it's scriptural. And then I wanted to play this last one that's a little bit long, but I want to see if you have the same reaction I did when I listened to this, because I was left totally confused. The words sound like English, but the sentences that they comprise don't make a whole heck of a lot of sense to me.
A significant critical mass of black biblical scholars, theological scholars, who were able to cut through some of this dominationist dialogue, discourse that has permeated Christendom. And with the result that the black church too often is held in thrall to the same kinds of misreadings of Jesus and the Gospels that we see in white churches, not just the patriarchy, but not the unwillingness, but the ambivalence about being political, seeing Jesus as a political figure, a political activist who is concerned about political egalitarianism, economic egalitarianism. And so, I mean, these are some of the opening tensions I'd like to raise, but I would like to make it clear that I do appreciate the deep centrality of the black church to black life, and the black church in many ways is the only thing that got us over.
What the hell does that mean?
But it's now
the black centrality of the black church
to a much
more
informed level, and not just talk about, well, you know, the black church is so revolutionary.
Of course,
boy, we're in the forefront, but
is
really
central
start to look
in
at
the black
it in a more
community,
incisive way,
as it
more,
is in much of the white
programmatic
community.
Way.
Dr. Forbes, if we could maybe extend this. On one hand, Professor Hendricks sets up this really strong tension between religion as theocratic, or black churches as driven by charismatic leaders, in contrast to a commitment to radical democracy that King is often believed to represent. You yourself are a product of churches that are often written out of the story of the black liberal Protestant establishment that King would represent, right? Baptist and Methodist churches. How might you see Pentecostal churches, but also the liberal Protestant tradition of a Riverside, as complicating that story?
Well, first of all, I think Genesis helps us to look at our problem, and that is that in Genesis, there is this snake that comes up and begins to engage in conversation with Eve. And the snake actually participates in calling into question what God said, and
which appears to be exactly what y'all are doing
right
now.
We should do. So that the major religious enterprise may be viewed as probably having distorted the nature of black being and suggested that God said one thing about who black folks are, and that the black church is God's rebuttal, saying this is what I said and not what the snake said. Now, snake is not, in the Farrakhan sense, calling other people demonic in this regard, but what this is that the God who calls all of us God's children, thereby suggesting the democratic ideal, that the black church gets caught between listening to what the snake said versus what God has clarified about who we are. And when the black church is really being the church that, in a sense, God uses to refute what was said by the other church, we are likely to be sensitive to the democratic ideal and engaged in activities that lead us to a more democratic society.
You know, I mean, folks, this was about as much drivel as I could possibly stomach. And I just want to point out, you know, we kept hearing a couple of themes in here. You're right, Rod. Well, but it's more than garbage. It's evil. Let's call it what it is. It's evil. And if these people truly believe in God and the gospel, then I suggest they start reading the gospel. Because I can tell you most certainly that what God created was not a democracy. What God created was not a theocracy. What God created was a monarchy. And he is the King of kings and the Lord of lords. There is none other. He is the head. He is the paternal creator of the universe and everything that's in it. He did not create a democracy. The whole of the Old Testament is laying out a procedure for governance of man. In fact, when we look at the covenant that arose with Israel, the Hebrews, the Israelites, why did that come about? Because man was not content to live under the ruler God. And so we wanted kings. We wanted governments. We wanted this democracy that these gas bags are up there blithering on about. That's what brought about, ladies and gentlemen, the covenant. God said, oh, you want a democracy? No problem. Here's the rules. And if you can keep them, everything will be straight. But if you transgress the laws, oh, well, the punishments are going to be very severe. But since you want to be democratic, I'm going to let you punish the members within your group. So when they misbehave, here's the punishment. You take them outside to the edge of town and you crush them to death with stones. And there's Levitical law. We can go through the whole book of Leviticus, but I don't think that that's really necessary. Here's my take on it. And this is what pisses me off about these people like Anthea Butler, who wants to write an article about folks like me and say we want to go back to the good old days, implying the days before civil rights, but more so implying the days of slavery. So I pulled up something that I wrote quite some time ago, and I want to read it to you, and then I'll let you guys weigh out, you know, what you think is right and whose heart is in the right place. In what has been termed our great experiment, we must first agree upon the foundational rules of interaction between government and the individual. The intent or spirit of this interaction is found in our Declaration of Independence, the result of which is our Constitution. The first statement is that government is created to secure or safeguard the liberty of the individual. The foundation of that statement rests upon the consent that all individuals are created equal, the result of which can be stated thus: the protection of the rights of one is the protection of the rights of all, thusly promoting the general welfare of society as a whole. If these basic rules are obeyed, they place upon government a restraint that cannot be overcome by consensus or majority. Without this restraint, we are at the mercy of the majority for our very existence. The right of the individual is not absolute in every instance. When the exercise of an individual right intrudes or diminishes the right of another, it is not permissible and is therefore restrained. Now, I would argue that in practice, the right may still be exercised. However, doing so implies the acceptance of the consequences established by law and administered through the due process of the same. You know, today the conflict of compromise is killing the idea of liberty. We have compromised our rights or allowed them to be compromised for what appear to be well-intentioned ideas. Only now are we beginning to see the unintended consequences of doing so. You know the old adage, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. And I believe we are witnessing the truth of that statement today. From what I can find, the problem in part stems from the idea that government has an obligation to control crime. However, that is not accurate, and as the statistics and history has proven, it is also not possible. Government has an obligation to punish crime based on the crime and the applicable law. In an attempt to prevent crime, we have created a new class of criminals and punish those who have committed no crime at all. Now, in regards to the General Welfare and Necessary and Proper Clause, at the Virginia Ratifying Convention, Patrick Henry took the opposing view, saying that the clause would lead to limitless federal power that would inevitably menace civil liberties. And so, ladies and gentlemen, it has. When the public good may require it. This is a phrase that is used to justify most of the statutes passed by our governments. After all, who could argue with promoting the public good? The problem is one of function over perception. How has the vast body of law created over the past 80 years promoted the public good? Unemployment, debt, crime, earnings, all have suffered, while government control, regulation, scope, and revenue have increased, with all of the debt incurred by the increase funded by the public that is the object of these supposed benefits. You see, this is what I talked about before, that today's problems are yesterday's solutions. And if we could only just pragmatically take a step back from all that's going on around us and say, okay, wait a minute. We've been instituting all these rules and regulations and policies and laws and ideologies since at least the beginning of 1867 or 1868 with the Reconstruction Acts and the first Civil Rights Acts, okay? And truly, if we're getting closer to perfection, then why, ladies and gentlemen, is our society and our government falling apart at the seams? If all of these were such great ideas, if all of these policies and institutions being created were the solution, why then do we have compounded problems? My God, let's look at the sheer numbers of people living in poverty in the United States today, living on some form of government assistance because presumably they can't fend for themselves, versus the number of people in, say, 1920 or 1933 or 1947 or 1956 or 1968. But you get the idea. What passes as progress is it's regression. We've gotten worse, not better. we have absolutely gotten worse. Technology has advanced, but that's about the only thing that's advanced, and it's advanced in spite of all the hurdles and stumbling blocks that we throw in front of one another. And you know, to me, the idea in our declaration was perfection, or as close to perfection as we can get as human beings. The fact that we did not honor the statement that all men are created equal does not mean, ladies and gentlemen, that we should throw the baby out with the bathwater and completely demolish the foundation of what was as close to perfection as we could get. No, sir. This is not how we go about doing it, but that's exactly what we've been doing for the last 80 plus years. Over 80 years. My God. Had we not bowed down and bared our souls to our sin of slavery, had we took a strong course and said, no, sir, perhaps we wouldn't be in this situation today. But we've been too accommodating, and we've turned the whole idea of slavery upside down on its head, but we still have to this day slavery, just not in the fashion that we're accustomed to reading about it in history. With that, I'm going to quit blathering on, and I'm going to bring Mr. Robert in. He's been holding very patiently. Bonjour. Bonjour, Mr. Robert. How did you like that?
The moral of the story is, I guess we've been damn slaves all our lives. I didn't know it.
How did you like that? And, I was floored. I got to tell you, I was absolutely just blown away listening to that panel on Sunday. And I have to admit that, a few buzzwords jumped out at me. But for the majority of it, I was left wondering, what the hell did they just say?
It's amazing. Just amazing what religion is doing to everybody.
Now wait a minute. Let's back this up. And I mean, I guess it depends on how you define religion. But what these people are doing is not religion. What they're doing is trying to bastardize the gospel of Jesus Christ and twist the wording to fit their ideology. And my God. Wasn't there? I seem to remember something in the scripture about, this is not of any private interpretation. And you've got this one fella up there talking about, the black church largely suffers from the same misreading of the gospel as the white church. Pardon me, sir, could that be because they're both reading the same frickin' gospel?
I don't know.
What they seem to be trying to imply with the one pastor talking about the snake conversation. So the implication, if I'm hearing correctly what they're implying, is that...
I didn't like that either.
It seems to me the implication, if I'm hearing properly what they're... tempting to say with English, but I mean, they're all over the map. It's kind of like they're trying to say it without saying it. But the implication, if I'm reading it correctly, is that the white man, the European tradition of the gospel, is the snake, the misrepresentation. And we're the ones, after all, that educated the blacks in the gospel. We taught them how to read, we told them what the gospel means, right? And so, of course, they have picked up with the same misinterpretation that the snake had. And it's time for them to turn that around, use the proper interpretation of the scripture, and throw it back on the snake, which would be the white man. I mean, this is the most insane, innocuous load of buffalo chips I think I've heard in quite a while. But I did notice that the good reverend was familiar with our good buddy Louie up there in Chicagoland, Mr. Farrakhan, the devout Christian that he is.
All right. What are we going to do? It's gotten to the point that everybody's trying to mix religion with politics and twisting the words. And I don't think there's any words to twist anymore. I think we've done twisting.
Well, in the words of one of our former Supreme Court justices, linguistic gymnastics is what's being used, and it abounds. And, I think it's so, it's almost humorous, but at the same time, it's very sad. Because I see these people that get up in front of these audiences, they write books, they expound on their higher education. They are so convinced of their own wisdom. They don't recognize, they don't realize that when they get up there and start talking like this, to me, what I hear is a bunch of frickin' idiots that are trying to pass themselves off as having wisdom and knowledge. And they clearly don't. And I hear it from the atheists, too. I mean, don't misunderstand me. They have a good vocabulary. They're usually well out of context and all over the map. And they never really make a coherent statement. I mean, what the hell was the one pastor talking about, a democratic gospel that embraces same-sex love? Are you freaking kidding me?
Well, I saw Rush Limbaugh last night, and he made a great point. And the point he was trying to make is, the reason why Detroit's the way it is, it's Agenda 21, like Bill says, And the black people keep on electing these people
I'm sorry, but I just cannot allow you or Rush Limbaugh to get away with making a statement like that. I think it's pretty obvious at this point that the reason that Detroit is in the situation it is in is exactly what the one Anthea Butler was talking about, that, it's a right-wing theocracy.
What is the right-wing? What is the right-wing theocracy then, Ron? If we're right-wing, if we're supposedly right-wing, then what is it? I mean, we're just as guilty as anybody else is.
Right, but the implication is, Robert, that the Christian right in the United States is in charge of the federal government, and it is running it like the Muslims run their theocratic governments overseas. And so what they're saying, straight to the point, is that the United States of America, the American government, is nothing more than a right-wing theocracy.
I don't believe any of them. I don't believe it's gotten to the point, Ron, that it's gotten to the point where right now I'm just surviving and I live each day, I breathe each day, and I just hope I wake up the next day.
Sure. what was the other pigeonhole progressive on MSLSD that said that, Detroit is the perfect example, this is what you get when you have a government small enough to drown in your own bathtub. Detroit is the result of the Republican conservative ideals. And of course, you got to work capitalism in there. We've gone crazy with capitalism.
It is what it is, Ron.
It's insanity is what it is.
Well, it is insanity. it's all it is psychological warfare. I said that before. It's, you know, who's gonna outwit who? If you can beat the psychological warfare, you'll be fine. It's a matter of if your mind's strong enough to do it. That's basically what it boils down to.
My mind is more than strong enough to do it. I just sit back and marvel at the pure ignorance that actually passes for intelligence. This is, you know, we talk about upside down bizarro world. This is it. It doesn't get any more upside down or bizarre. It's exactly what, you know, coming out of scripture, you know, talking about calling evil good and good evil.
You know, it's just like Pugliotti, her brother, passed away last night.
Oh no!
And
sorry.
Yeah, I know. I know. I have to go to California for the funeral. But last Sunday we were at the black funeral home where her ex mother-in-law passed away. And, you know, Ron, they treat me, even though she's divorced, her ex's family treats me like one of their own. You know, I mean, you know, so I disregard everything that these black preachers say because, you know, they beat me in. They treat me like family. I'm like one of their family now. You know what I'm saying? And it's just like, you know, we went to a they celebrated their 25 years of business in the funeral home. And, you know, I signed up, you know, I figured I might as well make funeral plans because I need to take care of my business, you know. And hell, I'm gonna take care of my funeral. We're set. We bought into the plan. If I die tomorrow, it's taken care of. It's all taken care of. And you know, they just, and not only that, we want to break $48 DB because of it.
You know, I didn't know they had raffles at a funeral home, but that's.
that's a true story. But that's a true story, and it's just, you know, it's just for them to take me as one of their own, and I just feel, you know,
the thing, this whole thing has really pissed me off. Because I do see the division and the seeds of division that are being sown at a feverish pace by, you know, this administration and many in the community, the black communities. They absolutely want total, complete control, and these progressives are nothing but a bunch of damn communist Marxist hogs.
Oh, sure. Their church did not see the way the other churches do.
But look, I know there are plenty of black communities and black churches that welcome everybody. But, that is the spirit that we need to be embracing, not this junk that these others are preaching. And I want to read you a letter that I wrote when Barack Obama first got elected. And I save all this stuff on my computer, and from time to time I go back and read it because it does help me to recenter. Because sometimes I lose track. I get caught up in all the crap that's going on. So I said, "Dear President Obama, I would like to congratulate you on your election as our 44th president. I must admit that I did not vote for you in the election or the primaries. However, I, like many other Americans, cannot help but feel a sense of encouragement by your words and the effect that your election has had on all of us. I feel as though we are again united as a nation. It is precisely that sense of unity that makes it seem possible for us all to finally break the chains of bondage and discrimination that have bound our nation and our society. Our nation began as a dream, an idea, one of equality and justice, a nation where every individual, regardless of the peculiarities of life and circumstance, could rest secure in the liberty of life itself, free to pursue that life in spite of the struggle of the task, and to live life while yet in pursuit of it. The free will to engage in one's own pursuits so long as they do not encroach on the pursuits of others. Admittedly, the struggle has been long, and a heavy price has been paid by many in our quest for freedom, equality, justice, humanity. Will we now condemn the sacrifice of so many to the pages of history as a struggle fought in vain? Today, as you take in all that has come before, are you able to see all that can yet be? Can you envision a world where mankind sees with its own eyes that we are simply caretakers? What will we pass along into the care of our children? Will it be a world of debt, slavery, and war? We as a society have much to apologize for. In our tireless pursuit of progress and liberty, we have destroyed the very things we claim to seek. I can scarcely imagine a freedom more complete and profound than that which was enjoyed by the native peoples that have been destroyed in our pursuit of progress and civil society. In the name of progress and society, we have enslaved our fellow human beings for our own selfish and petty desires. We continue to do this to this very day. We have, of course, changed the name of this slavery, but slavery it is all the same. The irony is that we are all enslaved, slaves to our own ignorance and our own stubborn refusal of freedom. Who then shall we apologize to? Those who have fallen to the sword of progress? Perhaps the future generations that we have robbed today, that we might keep alive the myth of our great prosperity, even as we create more debt so that we may once again prosper? The general welfare of our society is evidenced by the debt that we have amassed, a debt that will not be satisfied by labor alone. We are sowing the seeds today for the wars of tomorrow. We will not find the balance and equity we claim to seek until we lose our fear of freedom. Only then will mankind be truly free, to succeed or fail each on his own merits. Only then will we realize true charity and humanity. Freedom is the natural consequence of life itself. The Founding Fathers recognized this fact when drafting our Declaration of Independence. A moment of clarity in a history of tyranny and oppression when one small group would no longer consent to be enslaved. Sir, you campaigned on the hope of change. This time, more than any other, it is change the people will demand. The change must be profound, one that will strike fear and yet bring great hope. There is one change that will set things right. To attempt it will require tremendous courage and a clear vision. You, sir, possess the courage to break the chains of bondage that our government imposes upon the people who create it. Or will you refuse to see the discrimination and oppression until the people once again rise up and refuse to consent?
Wow. Speed of response.
Of course.
Man, that's a good letter, Ron.
Well,
that's,
you know,
great letter.
I had to think through because I wanted to get some of their little buzzwords and phrases when we talk about progress, but it's the truth. What I wrote in there
is
true. And I did feel very encouraged, although I knew it was probably, well, it was a fool's errand, I suppose, or a fool's hope that, hey, maybe this guy's not really the scumbag that he appears to be, and maybe he really will do something to unite this country. Because I honestly believe that even though, as I said, I didn't vote for him, I know a lot of people didn't, but there was just something about the fact that we really had elected our first black president that I thought, maybe, just maybe, this is a time where we can actually come together and put aside our divisions and become closer as a country, as a society.
I felt the same way, Ron. I wanted him to succeed so bad.
I did too, Robert, and I was very proud of the fact that, you know, even though he wasn't in my party, he wasn't my guy, and I didn't believe the crap that he was, you know, promising on the campaign trail, but at the same time, a little part of me was like, all right, you know, this is cool. Maybe this is the beginning of something new and a new page, a new chapter, and we can actually take another step closer to fulfilling that perfect idea that was outlined in our Declaration of Independence, but of course, it hasn't turned out that way.
Hell, Ron, I have his baseball cap. Obama, 44th President of the United States of America. You know, I was honored. I wanted him to succeed. And now I don't see any president succeeding at this point in time, Ron. I think we might as well not even have a Congress, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, you know, Congress has largely been, you know, neutered, haven't they? I would have to say.
Yeah, I think.
In light of all the things going on in our world today, when we look around, you know, how can you blame the American people for being confused? My God. I mean, there's I don't get it. I just don't get it.
Hello?
And, you know, yo, I'm here. You know,
okay.
I want to read you just a quick thing from, back in 2012, right? Al-Qaeda so weak that U.S.-Afghanistan withdrawal would be justified. Drone strikes and covert operations have weakened Afghanistan's Al-Qaeda network to the extent that a speedier-than-planned withdrawal of U.S. troops would be justified, according to officials in the Obama administration. Okay. Now let's go over to U.S. Army awards contracts to Al-Qaeda members. Now, I'm going to give you a quote. John Sopko is the Special Inspector General for Afghanistan Reconstruction. Wow, that's a mouthful. He released a lengthy report exposing these contracts and the Army's refusal to terminate. And I quote, "In conclusion, I would also like to reiterate the concerns I raised in our last report about the Army's refusal to act on SIGAR's SIGAR's recommendations to prevent supporters of the insurgency, including supporters of the Taliban, Haqqani Network, and Al-Qaeda, from receiving government contracts. SIGAR referred 43 such cases to the Army recommending suspension and debarment based on the detailed supporting information demonstrating that these individuals and companies are providing material support to the insurgency in Afghanistan, but the Army rejected all 43 cases. The Army Suspension and Debarment Office appears to believe that suspension or debarment of these individuals and companies would be a violation of their due process rights if based on classified information or if based on the findings by the Department of Commerce. I am deeply troubled that the U.S. military can pursue, attack, and even kill terrorists and their supporters, but that some in the U.S. government believe we cannot prevent these same people from receiving a government contract."
That's unbelievable.
Right? So, I mean, my goodness, let's see. You've got, Al-Qaeda is stronger than we thought. We've got these new warnings out for our embassies. Watch out, terror alert. We've got to shut down the embassies. This is the most credible threat. It's the biggest thing we've seen since 9/11. Oh, my God. Oh, wait, what's this article? Again, Al-Qaeda is so weak that Afghanistan could withdraw, a U.S. Afghanistan withdrawal would be justified. Then we turn out and find out that we're awarding government defense contracts to rebuild the crap that we just blew up to the very people that are fighting us in Afghanistan. How awesome is that? There, ladies and gentlemen, is your damn tax dollars at work. There is proof positive of your government-funded terrorist organization, not to mention the fact that we also know that we're funding Al-Qaeda in Syria. But now, of course, when we tune into the news, we're told that, Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, they're the ones we've got to watch for this terror alert. Never mind about Al-Qaeda in Syria, because they're the good guys. I mean, after all, they're just killing a few Christians up there that we're paying for it. And I found this today, and I thought, now, isn't this just the cat's meow? The coup de grace, if you will. Newt Gingrich sees major Mideast mistakes, rethinks his neocon views on intervention. I am a neoconservative, but at some point, even if you are a neocon, you need to take a deep breath to ask if our strategies in the Middle East have succeeded. The 2012 Republican hopeful said in an interview. Mr. Gingrich supported the U.S. invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, but said he has had increasingly doubted the strategy of attempting to export democracy by force to countries where the religion and culture are not hospitable to Western values. Quote, it may be that our capacity to export democracy is much more limited than we thought. And, quote, my worry about all this is not new. But my willingness to reach a conclusion is new.
I think they should just close them down permanently. To hell with them. They don't need
now,
them there.
Let's see. Mr. Gingrich said it's time for Republicans to heed some of the anti-interventionist ideas offered by the libertarian-minded Senator Rand Paul and Senator Ted Cruz. I think it would be healthy to go back and war game what alternative strategies would have been better. And I like Ted Cruz and Rand Paul because they are talking about it.
So, Ron, what do you think about the war between Rand Paul and Chris Christie? What's that feud about?
Oh, my God. And, you know, that was the other thing. Did you hear that? Did you know Chris Christie is killing black folk up there in New Jersey? I had not read that story. I must have missed it. I don't know what the hell they're talking about.
The Detroit police are killing all the black people, too.
Well, I'm sure, you know, because I don't think there's any white folks left for him to kill up there, is there?
Oh, my God. Ron, it takes me, I swear to God, it takes me 2 weeks to digest all this stuff, man. I get so irritated. I think we're ready for a micro beer. I think we need, it's time for a beer summit, Ron.
Doc, I'm not sure that Doc is asking a question about all the Muslim virgins, where they're going to come from. Well, there's a couple of things that I think have been noted in the past. Number one, I don't believe, and I've read the surah that contains the 72 virgin quote, nothing in there indicates that they'll be either female or even human. So... I mean, you know, you can use your imagination. There might be some goats running around up there that are, you know, waiting for the butter to be churned. I digressed enough already. I see we've got Miss Linda on the phone, so let me bring her in without further ado. Miss Linda, how are you here?
Fine. How are you guys doing? Hi, Robert and Ron and everybody in the chat. Anyway, there's so much to talk about. It's like, oh, my God, you don't even know where to start. That the video with those black people speaking about this, unbelievable.
Now you know, like, I told you. I felt like I needed to tear my skull open, pull my brain out, and slap it.
You know what they're doing. They're pontificating, and they're brainwashing their congregations. They're lying through their teeth, and they're not even anywhere near godly or biblical. All they are is socialists at best. I mean,
right.
That's
it appears to me that the strategy is to string together a long enough sentence of bullshit with a couple of key words and phrases in there like Jesus, gospel, progressive. Same-sex love, you know, just to plant the seed. Because the rest
of it
is all bullcrap filled.
What's really quite telling and quite coincidental in one sense, but, we know what's happening. We're in opposite land. And that other article you sent me by that clown that was talking about Reagan breaking the social contract. And I thought, okay, it was so similar to what these people were talking about. This is all the same nonsense. You know that where this is coming from. This is Marx and Engels, all of it, and Keynes. Come on. And nobody reads anything that hasn't been written by either Noam Chomsky or Howard Zinn, for the love of Pete. This is what's making me crazy. You know, and then... on another note, with the religious thing, did you hear about what's going on in San Antonio?
No.
I can't remember if it was just that city. That city council was saying that, I don't know if they wanted it statewide or just San Antonio, that anybody who, it was something written like in word or deed that believes or belongs to a group that believes that, you know, homosexuality is a sin, cannot work for the city government. And, I mean, this is...
Well,
this
good.
Is so,
you know, then the whole... Then the city will just be covered up with Peter Puffers. And they'll be too busy groping each other in the eight-man sleeper wagon, the orange and black eight-man sleeper wagon on the side of the highway to get any damn work done. And things will go on as business as usual because, you know, they don't get much work done anyway. That used to be an old joke back home in Illinois. What's black and orange and sleeps 12? It's a IDOT truck, Illinois Department of Transportation truck.
Oh, God.
10 supervisors and one guy running a shovel, you know, and 11 of them watching.
Unbelievable. Yeah, I know. Look, anyway, this is very, very, very Stalinish, so this is not good. Anyway, now the one, I was watching Glenn today, and this is how I found out about it. And now Pastor Hagee has said some things that none of us agree with, but the one thing, good thing that he's doing, because that's where he lives, in San Antonio, he did stand up in front of his congregation and he read these documents to them, and he said, anybody who votes, whoever's registered, please go to your city councils and say, no, this is not good. We don't like this.
Souls to the polls.
What?
Oh, wow. Souls to the polls. But I don't think that's exactly what they had in mind. But look on the bright side. At least all the gays will have a pension, right?
It's so crazy. But I was very happy that Pastor Hagee was going to do that. I mean, I don't agree with him on much, but this I do. I think that it should be stopped. All this nonsense should be stopped. We got to stop complying with this stuff and remaining silent. People, you know, this is nuts.
That's what I'm saying. You can call me a racist or any damn thing that makes you sleep better at night, but I'm going to start calling the truth, by God.
Yep.
I mean,
yep.
I'm just tired of hearing this crap. It's a bunch of garbage.
Yeah, we
got
to.
I'm not just
going to
let it slide.
No, we can't. Ooh. No, not. We're beyond that point. And that's why when you were talking about honoring things of the past, but, you know, look what they, I mean, just with that video alone and the things that they've been doing with the Jesse Jerksons and the Al Nusrans, you know, They have taken everything that Martin Luther King went through and did and accomplished and thrown it into the dustbin of history and stomped on it. It's just sickening. You know, I mean, I just get... And the other thing is, when you talk about the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and going by those things, we have dishonored Jefferson because he was the one who said that the seats of government and the government bureaucracies, et cetera, and these people need to be restrained and chained by the Constitution so that the people have the freedom. The people are not chained. The government is.
Well, see, and that's right. That's absolutely correct, and it's a restriction on the government.
Right.
It's a restraint. That's what I said in my blog post that I wrote some time ago.
Yep.
That was really about the Second Amendment, but it's broader than just the Second Amendment.
Sure.
If we embrace the idea that all men are created equal, and governments are instituted among men to safeguard the liberties of those men, right? Then the idea of justice and all that other stuff falls right in line, because if we embrace the idea that all men are created equal, then we don't attempt to use the force of government to elevate one group above another, or to give special privilege or determination to one group, status to one group over another. There are rich, there are poor, there are black, there are white, there are Asian, there are Hispanic, there are Jews,
there are Christians, there are atheists, there's lesbians,
there's homosexuals.
Who cares?
All of them are equal.
And you know what? You know what's interesting? Because these libtard progressives never think this way, because they're so trying to
promote their agenda, and they think by elevating one group above everyone else, and by diminishing another group by saying, oh, they're racist, or they're evil rich, or this or that, okay, all you're doing is creating division and envy. And we already know that that's not biblical. Envy is not biblical.
Right.
You're not supposed to covet.
Well, you know, this brings it around to what I had read back in probably about 4.5 years ago. And I'm going to give credit to him, because he wrote it, and it was Mark Levin's Liberty and Tyranny. And he was talking about commerce, free markets, and capitalism. And he says, let's get real. He says, you get up and you go to the market or whatever, and you buy your eggs. Do you care who drove those eggs in the truck? Do you care who plucked them out from under the hen? What color their skin was? No. You're hungry. Go get the food and eat. Get over it. I mean, this is how basic we got to start thinking. This is stupid, what these people are doing. It makes no sense to me.
Now, you know, one of the things that we've talked about, and I'm going to try and work on this, but it's difficult for me. I have to have like a streak of inspiration. But I want to look at, not perspiration, Robert. Settle down.
I'm sorry, Ron.
Well, I'm looking at a chronological timeline of the United States and the Middle East. And if we look at the period of time from 1918, does that ring a bell? What happened in 1918?
There was World War One somewhere in that mess.
There you go. We're winding up World War One. Now, do you remember something called a Balfour Declaration?
Yes.
Now, you remember... Yep. Quite some time ago, over a year ago, a gentleman was on my show and was calling me out in the chat room because I mentioned the Balfour Declaration, and he thought he was correcting me by saying that was World War One, and I said, well, you're right, it was World War One that the Balfour Declaration was contrived, but it wasn't realized until after World War Two, when it was put into practice. So, wouldn't you know, our timeline in the Middle East begins in 1918. And when you start looking from 1920 to 1928, and this is just a brief synopsis, the U.S. pressured Britain, the then dominant Middle Eastern power, into signing a red line agreement, providing that Middle Eastern oil will not be developed by any single power without the participation of the others. Standard Oil and Mobil obtained shares of the Iraq Petroleum Company. 1932 to 1934, oil is discovered in Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait. So let's back this up a little bit. There was already oil discovered and being harvested in Iraq and another country that seems to be of great concern these days, Iran.
Yep.
Okay? Now remember, I told you, if you go back and study the history of Persia before it became Iran, what you'll find is that there was Soviets kept trying to have incursions into Iran to annex Iran. And the United States didn't like that, and we actually had befriended Iran way back in the 1800s. We had people go over there. So when you have this oil discovery, there it was British Petroleum, by the way, that developed the oil wells in Iran. So now in the 1920s, the U.S. forces Britain to go into this red line agreement. We're going to share all the oil that these poor camel riders have. Then, in the 1930s, oil is discovered in Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, and Kuwait. And the U.S. oil companies obtain concessions from those countries. Well, we know what comes next. World War II. The U.S. State Department memo refers to Middle Eastern oil as a stupendous source of strategic power and one of the greatest material prizes in world history. Now, this is 1944. During U.S.-British negotiations over control of the Middle Eastern oil, you hearing this? President Roosevelt sketches out a map of the Middle East and tells the British ambassador, "Persian oil is yours. We share the oil of Iraq and Kuwait, and Saudi Arabia is ours." That was August 8, 1944. The Anglo-American Petroleum Agreement is signed, splitting Middle Eastern oil between the U.S. and Britain.
So Roosevelt's the culprit. He's the culprit of the whole thing.
Between 1948 and 1960, Western Capital earns $12.8 billion in profits from the production, refining, and sale of Middle Eastern oil on fixed investments totaling $1.3
billion. Wow.
Now, replacing rivals and waging war on national liberation. 1946, Harry Truman threatens to drop a super bomb on the Soviet Union if it does not withdraw from Kurdistan, Azerbaijan, in northern Iran. Wow, here we go again, the Soviets trying their little incursions into northern Iran. 1947, the U.S. helps push through a U.N. resolution partitioning Palestine into a Zionist state and an Arab state, giving the Zionist authorities control of 54% of the land. At that time, Jewish settlers comprised one-third of the population. May 14, 1948, war breaks out between newly proclaimed State of Israel and Egypt, Iraq, Jordan, and Syria, who had moved troops into Palestine to oppose the partition of Palestine. Israel attacked, forced some 800,000 Palestinians, two-thirds of the population, to flee into exile into Lebanon, Jordan, Syria, Gaza, and the West Bank. Israel seizes 77% of historic Palestine. The U.S. quickly recognizes Israel. Ah, so did the Soviets. That was our UN vote. Move forward. March 29, 1949. The CIA backs a military coup overthrowing the elected government of Syria and establishes a military dictatorship under Colonel Khayyam. 1952. U.S.-led military alliance expands into the Middle East with Turkey's admission to NATO. 1953. The CIA organizes a coup overthrowing Mossadegh's government of Iran after Mossadegh nationalizes British oil holdings in Iran's oil fields. The Shah, Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, is put on the throne, ruling as an absolute monarch for the next 25 years, torturing, killing, and imprisoning his political opponents. 1955, the U.S. installs powerful radar systems in Turkey to spy on the Soviet Union. 1956, after Egypt's nationalist leader, Gamal Abdel Nasser, receives arms from the Soviet Union, the U.S. withdraws promised funding for Aswan Dam, Egypt's main development project. Okay, their main development project, and we're funding it. This sounds a lot like the IMF and the Bank of the Reconstruction Bank. Okay, a week later, Nasser nationalizes the Suez Canal to fund the project. In October, Britain, France, and Israel invade Egypt to retake the canal. Eisenhower threatens to use nuclear weapons if the Soviet intervenes on Egypt's side, and at the same time, the U.S. asserts its regional dominance by forcing Britain, France, and Israel to withdraw from Egypt. 1956, a planned CIA coup to overthrow a left-leaning government in Syria is aborted because it was scheduled for the same day Israel, Britain, and France invade Egypt. 1957, Congress approves the Eisenhower Doctrine, something the United States still regards as vital to the national interest and world peace, the preservation of the independence and the integrity of the nations of the Middle East. Really?
Unbelievable. So,
I mean,
what do you make
this
of
goes on. This goes on all the way up through, you know, this thing rolls all the way up to 2001 is where it ends. But, you know, this is just some new revelation that, okay, that's fine. Now the U.S., we're going to have to get involved. We've been in the middle of this shit since it started. We are the ones who started this crap.
I know. Yeah, and we wonder why things go the way they go. I know. It's sick.
You cannot go back and read the history on the Balfour Declaration, okay, and know in hindsight what transpired in World War One.
Mm-hmm.
What the English did, and this is why it was Britain that was in Palestine, the Levant, right, after World War One, and we're going to hand over control to the Jews, the Zionists. Pardon me, Robert, I don't mean to include you in that group as being Jewish per se. Until it created tensions. It created tension, and the Zionists were pissed that, you know, they weren't getting their way, and the Brits were like, well, wait a minute, this is starting to cause a conflict, and they didn't want to start another conflict. And so what happens, the Zionists firebomb the damn hotel that the British officers were staying in.
Lovely.
Well, that was the end of that. They said, hey, you know what? Screw you guys. You're not getting anything. So then it wasn't until after World War II that they were able to get the realization of that Balfour Declaration at the end of World War II. And, you know, this, I'm not trying to call someone out for being Jewish. I'm calling out the World Zionist Organization and those friends of Karl Marx, the communist rabbi, Mr. Herzl and company, that were founding members of the World Zionist Organization that was trying to repopulate Jerusalem, Israel.
I guess that negates me for being a professional victim.
Well, I mean, I don't know.
I'm giving you the business, Ron. I'm giving you a run.
Oh, I understand. But, that's the thing. Our understanding is so damn short-sighted.
Right.
When it comes to the history of what was going on. That, you know, it descends into, oh, well, it's because the Muslims hate the Jews and they've been fighting over there forever. Well, that's just not true. Now, it may be true
exactly.
that the Muslims hate the Jews, and it may be true that they've been fighting for a while, but they haven't been fighting forever. And that's why it's to me important to point out that from 70 A.D., okay,
mm-hmm.
until 580, there was no Islam. There was no fight in Palestine. There also
right.
was no Israel in Palestine. There was no Zionist organization. There was nothing. There was people living together.
Right. They're all cousins, Ron. They were cousins. They were
well,
related
I realize
to each
that.
Other.
I realize that, Robert. That's why it's funny when I hear people call, you know, these Arabic Muslims anti-Semitic because they're Semitic. They're Semitic,
yep.
for God's sake. But the public is so ignorant.
I know. It's
that they
they're
don't
beyond.
Understand these things. And so it's really easy for them to say, well, they've been fighting forever. Well, that is a bastardization of Isaac and Ishmael. And that's all it is, pure and simple.
I mean, it's just like my roommate when I was in the University of Basel, Las Vegas, you know, when I was studying music. And my roommate was from Saudi Arabia. He's from Kuwait. And he was a geology major, and all of his cousins were all geology majors.
And he didn't behead you in your room at night?
I had an Arab roommate. We were best of friends. They treated me like I was one.
You didn't get nervous when he sharpened his scimitar in the evenings?
No, I mean that guy protected me. We protected each other. We were like brothers because during that time, remember, in 1988 when Iran and
I'm fully aware. They
were at that time at the university. The white students were beaten up on my roommate's cousins. They were just like beating the crap out of each other, you know. And I was in the middle of it. You know, we were just protecting each other. Yeah, we were protecting each other. You know, it was unbelievable. It was like a riot. But you know, it was like I have to tell you all a story about that. It was just like one day we were sitting there, and my roommate was talking about how he was missing his family, right? And I said, well, I told him, I said, well, you're homesick. Well, he took that as, he goes, my home is not sick, and he starts tackling me, and starts beating the crap out of me, Ron. And I had to get him in my famous headlock and press him down to the ground and just says, look up the word homesick, you son of a bitch. Take it as an insult, you know?
Well, now, I want to ask y'all, and it's unfair, kind of a rhetorical question, I guess, but, you know, I'm sitting here reading this. Do you anybody remember what was going on over in the Middle East in 1957? Because this is actually almost comical.
No.
Well,
I was
in April,
2 years old.
In April of 1957, just follow along, boys and girls, this is 1957, not 2012 or 11 or 10. After anti-government rioting breaks out in Jordan, the United States rushes the 6th Fleet to the Eastern Mediterranean and lands a battalion of Marines in Lebanon to, quote, prepare for possible future intervention in Jordan. Later that year, the CIA begins making secret payments of millions a year to Jordan's King Hussein. September 1957, in response to the Syrian government's more nationalist and pro-Soviet policies, the U.S. sends the 6th Fleet to the Eastern Mediterranean and rushes armed to allies Jordan, Lebanon, Iraq, Turkey, and Saudi Arabia. Really? Lebanon and Iraq? We were arming them back in the 50s, eh?
Wow.
Meanwhile, the U.S. encourages Turkey to mass 50,000 troops on Syria's northern border. This is sounding a lot like things going on today. 1958, the merger of Syria and Egypt into the United Arab Republic. The overthrow of the pro-U.S. King Faisal II in Iraq by nationalist military officers, and the outbreak of anti-government, anti-U.S. rioting in Lebanon, where the CIA had helped install President Kamil Kamen and kept him in power, leads the U.S. to dispatch 70 naval vessels, hundreds of aircraft, and 14,000 Marines to Lebanon to preserve stability. The U.S. threatens to use nuclear weapons if the Lebanese army resists, and to prevent an Iraqi move into the oil fields of Kuwait, and draws up secret plans for a joint invasion of Iraq with Turkey. The plan is shelved after the Soviet Union threatens to intervene. 1957-58, Kermit Roosevelt, the CIA agent in charge of the 1953 coup in Iran, plots, without success, to overthrow Egypt's Nasser. Between July 57 and October 58, the Egyptian and Syrian governments and media announced the uncovering of what appeared to be at least 8 separate conspiracies to overthrow one or the other government, to assassinate Nasser, and or prevent the expected merger of the two countries. 1960, U.S. works to covertly undermine the new government of Iraq by supporting anti-government Kurdish rebels and by attempting, unsuccessfully, to assassinate Iraq's leader, Abdul Karim Qasim, an army general who had restored relations with the Soviet Union and lifted the ban on Iraq's Communist Party. 1963, U.S. supports a coup by the Ba'ath Party, soon to be headed by Saddam Hussein, to overthrow the Qasim regime, including by giving the Ba'ath names of communists to murder. Armed with the names and whereabouts of individual communists, the National Guards carried out summary executions. Communists held in detention were dragged out of prison and shot without a hearing. By the end of the rule of the Ba'ath, its terror campaign had claimed the lives of an estimated 3,000 to 5,000 communists. We haven't quite made it to 1970 yet. But there we go, boys and girls. I mean, this is how we end up with who? Saddam Hussein, right? I mean, you know, I'm sorry for all those wannabe neocon war hawk patriots out there that want to wave the flag and be a nationalist, but you got blood on your hands, brother, and a hell of a lot of it.
So Saddam Hussein was in power since 1957?
No, but Saddam Hussein was a general in the Ba'ath Party who would rise to power with the help of the United States government, by the way. 1963, U.S. supports a coup by the Ba'ath Party, soon to be headed by Saddam Hussein.
I gotcha.
Yeah, see, look, when you start delving into these things, whether it's the bankers funding it or the, you know, factions funding each other, this is about territory, oil, power, money, and control, and it always has been. I mean, that's what's going on.
Yep. 1966, the U.S. sells its first jet bombers to Israel, breaking with the 1956 decision not to sell arms to the Zionist state. 1967, with U.S. weapons and support, Israeli military launches the so-called Six-Day War. seizing the remaining 23% of the historic Palestine, the West Bank, Gaza, East Jerusalem, along with Egypt's Sinai Peninsula and Syria's Golan Heights.
Wow.
1970, with U.S. and Israeli backing, Jordanian troops attacked Palestinian guerrilla camps, while Jordan's U.S. supported Air Force drops napalm from above. U.S. deploys the aircraft carrier Independence and six destroyers off the coast of Lebanon, and raises troops in Turkey to support the assault. The U.S. threatens to use nuclear weapons against the Soviet Union if it intervenes. 5,000 Palestinians are killed, 20,000 wounded. It becomes known as Black September. 73, the U.S. rushes $2.2 billion in emergency military aid to Israel after Egypt and Syria attack to regain the Golan Heights and Sinai. U.S. puts forces on alert and moves them into the region. When the Soviet Union threatens to intervene to prevent the destruction of Egypt's Third Army by Israel, the U.S. nuclear forces with DEFCON 3 to force Soviets to back down. 73-75, U.S. supports Kurdish rebels in Iraq in order to strengthen Iran and weaken the pro-Soviet Iraqi regime. When Iran and Iraq cut a deal, the U.S. withdraws support, denies the Kurds refuge in Iran, and stands by while the Iraqi government kills many Kurdish people.
Jeez.
79 to 84, U.S. supports paramilitary forces to undermine the government of South Yemen, which was allied with the Soviet Union. You wonder why all these bombers are coming out of Yemen, right? We keep hearing Yemen in the news. And
yep.
As the Iranian Revolution begins, 1978, against the hated Shah, the U.S. continues to support him without reservation and urges him to act forcefully against the masses. In August 78, some 400 Iranians are burned to death in the Rex Theater in Abadan after police chain and lock exit doors. On September 8th, 10,000 anti-Shah demonstrators are massacred at Tehran's Jalal Square.
Wow.
In 1979, the U.S. tries without success to organize a military coup to have the Shah. In January, the Shah is forced to flee, and the reactionary Shiite Islamists, led by Ayatollah Khomeini, take power.
Yep.
You know the rest of that story, right?
Right.
The U.S. publicly supports the Khomeini regime's efforts to suppress the Kurdish liberation struggle and maintain Iranian domination of Kurdistan. U.S. President Jimmy Carter designates the Persian Gulf a vital U.S. interest and declares the U.S. will go to war to ensure the flow of oil.
Iran-Contra. Wow.
And the beat goes on. I mean, guys, when you see it laid out, you know, it paints a wholly different picture than all the running around, the sky is falling, the terrorists are going to kill us all mentality that we hear. And these conflicting reports that, oh, you know, they're Al-Qaeda's so weak, the, you know, they couldn't pop a frickin' water balloon. And then, you know, 2 days later, my God, we're going to have to close our embassies. This is a legitimate threat. Really?
Yeah, this whole thing, it's I don't understand any of it. It's just, it's ticking me off. And why are they worried about the oil in halfway around the world when we in Canada have plenty right here? I don't understand it.
Well,
I don't understand
you
it.
You should, and especially now, because when we ended the Bretton Woods Agreement and went on the petrodollar standard, which, by the way, we negotiated with Saudi Arabia. See, we've always been on the side of the Saudis.
Apparently. Yeah.
Oh, and now you know why, because Roosevelt drew the map, and they belong to us.
Yep. Yep.
The Iranians belong to who? The British Crown.
Wow.
And
wow.
We planted our little Rottweiler over there in the Middle East just to keep them on a leash in the Zionist Israel.
Yep.
And
sick.
Always, they're always going to act as a springboard because, as I pointed out, they were the first professional victims. So that, well, no, and I mean that in all sincerity, Robert. You think about it. All you have to do is run a single news story that the Arabs are attacking the Jews in Israel, and it's game, set, and match. Nobody's going to hear anything other than it's those evil bastards attacking those poor, sweet Jews, God's chosen people, and we have to protect them. That's the ideology.
Yep. You know, Ron, my poor father, he embedded that in my brain since I was a little boy. And I, now what was it, you know? What can I tell you?
Well, and the reality is that these people that are pulling these strings don't give a damn about a Jew or their religion or anything close to it. They don't give a damn about God or pleasing God. What they give a damn about, control.
Yep, and money and power.
You know how I'm going to be buried, Ron? I'm going to be buried in mausoleum. You know why? Because I don't want dudes throwing dirt at my face. That's how
I
do it.
I thought you were going to say you were going to have your butt sticking out of the ground.
No, I don't want to be buried underground, man.
So they'd have a place to park their bike.
I don't want to be buried underground. I don't want to be underground. It was either that or being cremated in Jewish religion. I'm not supposed to be cremated, so you know, in the Jewish religion, if you're cremated, you go to hell. So what's the worst choice you have? You know. I mean, I feel so much at peace with myself that I got my funeral arrangements taken care of. I do. I feel. I don't have to worry. I don't have to worry about a thing. Yeah. You know.
Doc said he wants to be sedated.
I tell you. We're all sedated at this point in time.
Linda, and I put you a link up in the chat room to that time.
Okay.
You know, it's much more extensive than that. It goes all the way up to 2001.
Where'd you get that timeline, Ron?
It's www.revcom, revcom.us. /A/B23/1120-29
Shipping email, Ron. That is coming in an email.
Yeah, it's pretty long.
I know.
I don't
sure
know. Does your email still work?
Yeah, rscapital11@comcast.net. I got an email.
Comcast.net,
Yeah, that's my email.
Oh, I've got Verizon.net.
No, I'm with Comcast.
It's Comcast.
Okay. Well,
yeah,
can change.
Verizon and Comcast are merging now down here in Florida so they could tap our phones. God.
Yeah, there's no privacy. These guys, they got it wired, a rat.
I've been tapped all along, and I didn't even know it.
It's in your inbox, sir.
Oh my lord!
Okay, you got it, Robert.
What else is going on? What, they can see us through the TVs now.
I don't know.
You like that? Yeah, that's absolutely true.
You know, they can watch you. You know, walk in your office nude, and you can just give them a show.
The towel and the sneakers. Love it.
Oh, by the way, this program is brought to you by Carl's Jr.
Oh, no.
Pipe bomb.
I like Carl's Jr. They have great hamburgers.
Pressure cooker, backpack, jihad. Assassinate.
Rice cooker.
Yeah. Mushroom cloud, Washington, White House.
Oh my lord! I tell you, this is a sad state of affairs. This whole what is
it's crazy.
You know, well, what about Snowden? What do you think? What do you think should happen to that little son of a gun?
Who?
Snowden. Exactly.
Oh, Snowden.
Edward
Snowden.
Yeah, well, Do you remember the going back to timelines? Do you remember that summit that the Putin and Obama had? You know, I wait till after the election.
Tell Vladimir after the election. I think what he was referring to when he said he'd be more flexible is that, you know, he was stretching so he could put his ankles behind his ears. I don't know.
Yeah, absolutely.
I don't get it, yep. Linda. I don't get it anymore, Linda. I'm lost for words. I really am, man.
I think we all are. You know, all we can do is do what we're doing, prepare a lot, make sure you don't keep any money in the bank, just have a bug-out bag, have everything planned, just pray a lot. I don't know. I mean, I do what I can. I try to educate people. I try to go to city council meetings. Yeah, I heard that Organizing for Action, the brown shirts are going to be out at the town halls and city councils pushing for gun control again. If I run into them again this time, they're going to wish they'd never seen me. I'm not going to play this time. No.
Linda, I wish you would run for city council there. I really do. I wish you would run.
Well, then I'd have to resign when I get a chance to get out of California because I ain't staying here too much longer. But we'll see. Yeah, I like being on the other side of the fence so I can give them hell.
Yeah, well, all Leonie's family's in L.A., Linda. All her family's in L.A.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, I know. And some of them, I might be out there next week. I don't know yet.
All right.
I'll give you a call. I'll show you an email before I go.
Okay.
You know what I think, God, guys, this is, after all this stuff that's going on, this is truly how I honestly feel.
I'm about to whip somebody's ass. Oh, I'm about to whip somebody's ass. Oh, if you don't leave me alone, you're going to have to send me home. Because I'm about to whip somebody's ass.
That sums it up for me, guys.
I don't blame you, Ron. I feel the same way. I
That's cute. I had to turn down my computer. Go ahead. Funny.
I mean, seriously, I'm done with it. I'm overdone.
I don't think I can tell this joke on air, but I better not.
Well, I'm going to let you wrap it up because I'm getting a little tired, and I know I've probably missed a couple phone calls and stuff, and thank you for doing a great show, and God bless you guys, and I'm going to do an hour show tomorrow, and we're going to start with some praise and worship music for Bill's family because Boomer passed away, and we'll do a little tribute there, a little scriptural reading, and then we'll do some business and take calls and all that stuff. So God bless you guys.
Right.
Good talking to you, Robert. Good night, Ron.
God bless. Lord, I hope that Johnny is doing okay, and let her know that, give her a hug for me. Tell her I'm sorry for her loss of her brother. I know it's difficult when it's a close family member, most definitely. Any parting thoughts, sir?
I don't know what to say anymore. I just live and learn, just hope for the best, just keep on fighting. That's all we can do. What else can we live for, right? What else can we live for? I think that's the only thing we have left, Mr. Ron, is to have this program where we can let off steam.
Well, let me see if this is the correct clip. It may not be, but I'm going to try and play it because I think Ms. Barnhart had a suggestion.
The European Central Bank, they aren't even being coy about it anymore. They're not just printing euros, giving the euros to the banks and then letting it trickle into the sovereign paper market through banks. He's not even being cute about it anymore. The European Central Bank is now buying euros and buying sovereign bonds from these European nations directly. I cannot even begin to tell you how bad that is. That is the incestuous and the fundamental catastrophic disorder with that is can't even be described, to have a central bank buying the sovereign paper directly. Okay, next square down, which I believe is purple. As Spain sells more and more bonds, which is issuing debt, the Spanish debt-to-GDP ratio rises. Okay, if you've got this nation that's a hot mess to start with, and they keep blowing their debt bubble, and their debt-to-GDP ratio just keeps going up and up and up, as the market looks at that sovereign nation, in this case Spain, what is the market's perception? Is that better or worse? It's worse. So if it's worse, what does that do to the interest rate? It pushes it up even more, okay? So you see it's this cannibalistic eating your own tail dynamic. The more debt you blow, the higher your interest rate goes, okay? Next step, turquoise, I believe. As Spain's debt to GDP rises, the economy weakens. We're blowing a big debt bubble. We're a hot mess. The economy weakens. The economy slows down. It goes into a recession. Unemployment rises. Next step down, I believe that box is red. As economy weakens, the Spanish government increases debt, calling it stimulus and welfare. Because remember, as the economy weakened because of the increasing debt-to-GDP ratio, more people are going on welfare, and more people are demanding the government to do something. Well, what should the government do? Well, more stimulus, more stimulus, more stimulus. Well, wait a minute. That's just more new debt, which increases the debt-to-GDP ratio, which just makes the economy weaken even more. And it just keeps cycling and cycling and cycling. Next, the gold box. As Spain's economy weakens further, customers start defaulting on loans because people are losing their jobs. We're in a recession. Of course people are going to start defaulting on loans. Now, think back to what we just looked at on the Fells-Wargo balance sheet, right? Amy defaulting on her HELOC, Michelle defaulting on her credit card. Secured loans, such as real estate, are booked as being worth far more than they actually are, and unsecured loans are unsalvageable. The entire banking system is revealed to be insolvent. Bank runs begin. This is going on. This is already happening in Greece,
Cyprus,
in Spain,
Greece,
and to some
Spain.
Extent it's been happening in Italy as well. Okay? The poop is hitting the fan in the beginning phases in Europe, and that's what's coming here. Next, the green box. Systemic risk increases, thus raising interest rates in Spain. If there are bank runs going on and banks are failing left and right, what does that do to the interest rate market? Well, if I'm going to do this, if I'm going to give you my money, bank, I better be making a lot more than 0% on it in order to take on that risk. Interest rates and risk are positively correlated in a normal economic environment. As interest rates increase, Spain needs to borrow more money to service its sovereign debt and to bail out banks. Okay? Not only do they have to borrow more money just to pay the interest on the debt that they already have. Does anybody here in the room remember that in the early 80s, coming off of Carter, when people would literally have to go and take out loans just to make the interest payment on another loan, borrowing money just to make the interest payment? Yeah, yeah. And so blowing the debt bubble even more, and then it has to bail out the banks because the banks are failing. Right? So what does Spain have to do? It has to borrow more money from the European Central Bank in order to bail out its banks. This just keeps going and going and feeding on itself and feeding on itself. They're not helping anything over in Europe. They're just making it worse and worse and worse. Why are they doing this? A, because they're a bunch of political whores who will do anything to maintain their position of power. anything. Number two, a lot of them are imbeciles and do not understand even this simple logical progression.
This
I cannot
is the part
overemphasize
I'm talking about
this. Here. Stupid people are running the world. Okay, this whole politically correct thing has been one big culture of let's elevate people who are stupid into positions of massive power to prove how morally superior we are. Guys, this has got to stop. Intelligent people have got to reassert their primacy in the arena of ideas and governance. Oh my gosh, I can't believe she just said that. That sounds so racist. I don't give a crap. Smart people should be running things. Stupid people should not. This isn't unchristian. This is truth. You have to get this through your minds. Oh, and by the way, when you encounter people that are criminal psychopaths who will steal and rape and pillage and will do it without any moral hesitancy or compunction whatsoever, there's a solution for that. It's called execution, after due process, trial, and conviction. We have to start executing these people because that is the only thing that they will ever understand, and that is the only way that it will ever, ever stop.
What do you think of that, Robert?
How profound. Ron, by the way, September 13th, real quick, if you're interested.
Yes,
I don't know. Would you be interested in seeing Hannity in Sarasota?
No.
I kind of figured you wouldn't be. I was invited to go and see Hannity.
I wouldn't walk across the street to see him. I just wouldn't.
Statesman of the year, right?
Absolutely.
You know that?
And, you know, on this last note, because we've just got a couple of minutes left, I want to remind everyone what Hillary Clinton said about these Al-Qaeda terrorists that we're so fearful of right now, even though we've weakened them tremendously with our Middle Eastern foreign policy. So let's listen to Miss Hillary and what she had to say back a while ago.
We also have a history of kind of moving in and out of Pakistan. I mean, let's remember here, the people we are fighting today, we funded 20 years ago. And we did it because we were locked in this struggle with the Soviet Union. They invaded Afghanistan, and we did not want to see them control Central Asia. And we went to work. And it was President Reagan, in partnership with the Congress, led by Democrats, who said, you know what, sounds like a pretty good idea. Let's deal with the ISI and the Pakistani military, and let's go recruit these Mujahideen, and that's great. Let's get some to come from Saudi Arabia and other places, importing their Wahhabi brand of Islam so that we can go beat the Soviet Union. And guess what? They retreated. They lost billions of dollars, and it led to the collapse of the Soviet Union. So there's a very strong argument, which is wasn't a bad investment to end the Soviet Union, but let's be careful what we sow because we will harvest. So we then left Pakistan. We said, okay, fine. You deal with the stingers that we've left all over your country. You deal with the mines that are along the border. And by the way, we don't want to have anything to do with you. In fact, we're sanctioning you. So we stopped dealing with the Pakistani military and with ISI, and we now are making up for a lot of lost time.
Yeah.
Oh, man.
You know, it almost, dare I say, and now just, I mean, I'm going to go out on a limb here. Dare I say that Mr. Jeremiah Wright might have been right when he said America's chickens are coming home to roost? Just saying, folks. Robert, God bless you. Thanks for calling in. We'll see you all tomorrow.
You're welcome. Thank you, Ron.
Blog Talk Radio and Patriot Family is where you need to be if you want to be informed and inspired 5 days a week. On Monday at 7:30 p.m., you can listen to the Constitution Hour. On Tuesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Family Chat. On Wednesday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Right from the Left Coast. On Thursday at 6 p.m., you can listen to Patriot Education. And on Friday at 7 p.m., you can listen to Exposed but Never Forgotten. All times are Eastern Standard Time. Hope to see you there.